Welcome to the FMCG podcast. Make sure you're following us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave us a five-star review. It really helps us out. Enjoy the show.
Hi, good morning. My name is Rich and we are Consumer Hub and we focus on recruiting FMCG professionals across all kinds of different sectors, anything with a consumer focus. And this is the FMCG podcast where we speak to the leaders of today and hear their insights into their category and also their view on how careers develop, progress and what leadership looks like in the FMCG sector they're in. Thanks so much today for joining us, Amy. Really, really excited to have you on the show. Amy's from a business called Hunter & Gather. And just quickly, Amy, I don't want to tell everybody watching and listening what you do. Just give us a quick snapshot into you and your business. And again, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me. So exciting to be here and very poignant time because we're recruiting for quite a few roles. So going through a lot of these kind of pain points and exciting moments at once. So hopefully got a lot to share. So yeah, I'm Amy, one of the co-founders of Hunter & Gather. And Hunter & Gather is an ancestrally inspired real food and supplement, so cross-category brand in the FMCG world. And we play in condiments, supplements, kitchen staples, and we really see the brand being an omni-channel, cross-category health and wellness brand, a bit like Nike for the sports world, but in the food industry.
Oh, brilliant. So give us a snapshot into your story then. Like, where did the idea come from?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a lifelong journey. Everyone thinks that just one day you wake up with an idea and boom, you've kind of got a business. But for us, it really was kind of a long progression, both personally in our own health and well-being, but also in terms of business exposure as well. So for me, I'm a lifelong celiac. I was diagnosed at 18 months old, which was quite rare. So as soon as I was eating solid foods, massive kind of issues with stomach pains, really sick, had to go to hospital. Thankfully, I was diagnosed early, and the only way to really manage celiac, so a gluten-free lifestyle, is to manage it through lifestyle and diet alone. There is no medication, for example, definitely at that time. So over my kind of personal journey, I was having to know what was in food. There didn't even used to be allergens back on pack, let alone a gluten-free aisle back then. So making foods from scratch was really important, and that was really great for me. I didn't see it as a pain point at all. I was brought up eating real food, and that was amazing. As I developed into kind of teenage years, I met my partner, Jeff, who's also my co-founder now. And he was living much more of a conventional Western lifestyle, you know, Weetabix in the morning, extra sugar on top for the energy, which, as we all know now, wasn't the best move.
Definitely done that a lot.
Yeah. He was suffering with like acne and IBS. He had to call an ambulance for himself as well. And it was just, although he doesn't have celiac, he just saw the impact that like grains, high sugar, poor quality oils were having on his kind of life as well. And kind of that took a many years of like suddenly realizing, why do I not feel so good? Or why this isn't normal? Like waking up with stomach pains every day is not normal. Like you don't have to live in that way, having headaches all the time. And a lot of people just live day to day with that. So chance encounter for Jeff, actually, he had a run-in injury, and he had this encounter with a GB. I think he was a coach or a physio at the time. Jeff was, he likes to say, not at that GB standard, but it was, he was fortunate enough to be introduced. He was like, what are you eating? And he was like, I'm here for a problem with my knee, like not what I'm eating. And that was a light bulb moment that everything we eat is kind of like the foundation of health and it impacts everything. So that was kind of like the personal journey of eating real food. We learned about ancestral lifestyles, keto, paleo, and took principles for them for ourselves. And then in the world of kind of like professional, I worked for Mars in the pet food industry, so big corporate. And then I kind of through my learnings of like real food, I then looked at what I was doing in my career, the pet food, etc. Got my own pets and wanted the best for them as well. So I moved to a smaller startup, scale up at the time, called Livy's Kitchen, who were doing grain-free, organic, yeah, better for your pet food. And that just cemented, actually, that it's not doctors or vets that are saying what should be in the supermarket for us to buy for our health and wellness. It is brands going into these supermarkets, speaking with the buyers, educating them, that was making the change. So I'd seen that from a career perspective. And then combining all that together, it was kind of a light bulb moment that if we want to help people through the learnings that we had with real food and nutrition, the best way is to provide easy swaps and educate buyers and provide this option instead of the incumbent big brands that were adding sugar and seed oils and poor quality ingredients. And that's when the idea kind of for Hunter and Gabble was born. It was an education piece. And the products then kind of came second to that ethos of wanting to educate.
That's really interesting. That's fascinating. So kind of really, really sort of followed, I guess, followed your nose, followed the trail, really, sort of seeing where it would go. What was, because something that really interests me is just the brand name itself, like the name Hunter and Gather. Did you originally have that in mind when you started the business, or did that sort of come out as you know, because a lot of smaller companies that we've the podcast before or like we work with, they've had a few different brand names and it's taken a while for them to settle on, or did you always have that as like your guiding star, right? We know we wanted to kind of tap into this Hunter and Gather lifestyle, because it's very evocative straight away. As soon as you hear that name, you're like, oh right, I think I've got an idea of what that business might be about. It's really interesting.
Yeah, do you know what? We came up with that name in a day.
Did you?
Yeah, and it was because we kind of had to. So we was about to launch the brand. It was a week out from launching, and we had another name. And unfortunately, it was trademarked and everything in the UK. And this is a learning for some people. It'd gone through the whole process, amazing. And then we had a letter from a brand in the States saying that they owned the word primal. So we was having a similar vein. We knew it was ancestrally inspired name. We had the word primal and another word alongside it. So we got this letter saying, although you've got a UK trademark, like, we don't want you to use the term primal. We're like, that's surprising. There's so many primal brands out there across pet food, across this. Feel like a term that was owned by anyone in particular. But unfortunately, in the UK, it's a case of you would need to go to court to say why you should keep that name, or and you'd have to go into a bit of a battle. As a new brand, we cut our losses, and it felt like a big hit at the time because you've been working on this name for such a long time. You've got the social handles, you've got the email set up. We had the packaging ready for the first product. And we had a week before launch. So it was a case of, right, let's sit down. Do you know what? We're so glad it happened. And hindsight is everything, because we looked back and was like, okay, what's important to us? It's eating how our ancestors would have. So we want an ancestral element. How do we bring ourselves into the brand as well? And my grandparents are Hunts and Jeff's are Gabbergoods.
Really?
So, wow. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, we were like, oh, Hunt and Gabbergood. And then we was like, okay, we can shorten that down and make it a little bit more snappy. We'll go Hunter and Gabber. And that then feeds back to us as both the founders. It harks back to that ancestral philosophy, eat like your grandparents would. And it really symbolizes kind of what we stand for. People generally get a gist of what we're about in the name. The only thing we do get questioned is the syntax is wrong. So it's normally Hunter Gabbera.
Okay.
We're Hunter Gabbera. But it is based on two names. And it does stand out. So I think that helps us as well.
Yeah, no, it definitely stands out. Yeah. And I like brands that have, they sort of imply what they do in the name as well. I think it actually helps as a, if you're a new brand and you're trying to kind of get your eye in, as a shopper and consumer, you don't have the time. It just helps you work out, is this something I want to spend time on? Which I imagine must be like just invaluable for you trying to get cooked through in a noisy marketplace. Just on that point, how have you differentiated? Like, where do you sort of position yourselves? You kind of touched on it earlier saying, you know, it's kind of core grocery sort of categories and almost like swap outs for some of the bigger sugar-full brands. Can you just kind of take us through that a bit? Because it's really interesting for people to understand, like, okay, so what kind of occasion can I go to Hunter and Gather for if I'm cooking, etc.?
Yeah, so our overarching ethos, and one of the reasons we chose the name Hunter and Gather as well, is it's about that ethos versus this particular product. So you'll find a lot of brands will name themselves after one particular category, and they pigeonhole themselves and would have to change the name to broaden out of said category. An example of that is Collie Rice had to change their name down the line as they expanded out of cauliflower rice, and they're now Full Green. So you can do that. Obviously, you could evolve, but for us, we started with that overarching ethos anyway. So we want the brand to be a stamp of quality on anything consumable, but also any product that you would kind of use in your daily life. So that would be supplements, that would be cooking items. It would even move into like beauty and deodorants. Yeah. Or we're not defined so much by a set category, and we are 80% e-commerce. So that also helps because we can be much broader. We want to be known for an ethos. So we want people to know that they can come to Hunter and Gather. Everything that we do will fit a promise. So always refined sugar-free, always grain-free and gluten-free and seed oil-free. And that the foundations of it are natural quality, real ingredients that aren't toxic to you. So that's kind of the ethos. So whether you're coming for, everyday consumables, your food, your supplements, you know it's going to be quality. And we want that to stand out on shelf as well as online as well.
Right, that is really interesting. Just that point about stockists, that's really interesting. So, I mean, you guys have got a good rep now. I reckon a lot of people are probably aware, because obviously you won the Forbes 30 in 30 accolade, and you seem to have some really good kind of quality noise out there around the mission on LinkedIn anyway. When it comes to like the cut through in terms of like routes to market, a lot of businesses that I've spoken to at your stage of the journey, they're really trying to like leverage into like sort of traditional grocery retail. But it sounds like you're very, very happy with being like at the moment, a very strong D2C outfit. Was that a conscious decision? Is it something that's just kind of worked for you and evolved? Like, just talk me through the mindset around that route to market piece, because I think it's really hard to get right as a new brand, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we would love to work with grocery when the time is right and with the right partner, but we'd like it to be a partnership rather than being a risk for both the retailer and the brand. If you go into a big grocery early on, and especially when you're like a new type of section of a category, so avocado mayo, when we first launched, which was our first product, so unique. It was the first of its kind in Europe. People hadn't really heard of it. So it would have been quite a risk for us to go into grocery in that way. We knew from my career as well that you can have a strong e-commerce presence in FMCG brands. Lily's Kitchen did as well, D2C and Amazon. And we were like, we saw this movement to online way before COVID, and we saw it being as a low barrier to entry. So we put a website up ourselves. It didn't cost us really anything. We built it ourselves. Amazon, really easy to work with. And at the same time, we did get listings like Whole Foods Market, etc. But it was about building a tribe first, rather than going all out there. It's like, don't run before you can walk. Mm-hmm. Don't put your product in national press if you're not available nationally. Like, go, like, be at the stage that you are, and having a niche, tight-knit community is not a word that you should be afraid of as an entrepreneur. Like, it means you'll have early adopters, people that will love the brand, that will stay with the brand. We call them sneezers.
Sneezers.
Which during COVID was an awkward one. Hopefully we can get past it now, but someone coined this term. It wasn't me. It was in a book that I read, but it's a sneezer is someone that is intoxicated with your brand so early on that they go and tell everyone else. Like, They are early adopters. They absolutely get you and they will spread. And the more sneezes you can get early on, the more people you'll expect. Sounds a bit weird now, COVID.
Brilliant. I've never heard that before, but I'm 100% pinching it. That's awesome.
You see that happen within the Facebook groups. It was quite early, like keto paleo was quite a new thing here. It's like 5-6 years ago. And those core people that were championing that, they were open to new products, new ideas. They've been waiting for these. And as soon as we came onto the market, they just instantly got us, supported us. And it went from me like sharing about the brand within these Facebook groups to anybody that asks a question like, what matter can I have? 20 people will be like, Hunter and Gabba, Hunter and Gabba. Who's the best collagen? Hunter and Gabba, Hunter and Gabba. So, and now we have our own Facebook group as well. Like people ask questions in there and our early adopters and sneezers and brand advocates answer it before me. So someone will be like, have you changed the bottle or have you done this? And then like people will answer it for me. So it's really cool to see that there's people out there that take that interest in your brand. And we're quite open, transparent as a brand. I even share down to what design would you like on this new exciting product launch I'm doing. And it's for our closed Facebook group. So it's still got 3,000 people in there, I think, or over that now. But they get to see and interact with like the development of the brand. So that's key. And you can do that online versus a grocery. Grocery is quite faceless initially.
That is honestly like a fascinating insight. Like I've seen so many people shout about, we know we've gone to zero to Tesco listings in 2 years, but I've also seen lots of people that look like they're going to smash it, just fall off a cliff, and then founders will put out a post saying, look, you know, we XYZ problems. And sometimes it just looks like people have been caught up in the sort of the hype and the perceived kudos of being in a Tesco's rather than just doubling down on the mission. And what really comes across there, which is great here, is just like an obsession with the actual like core USP of the brand's values, like rather than just kind of convenience at all costs. Because sometimes I do think, you know, brands, they're so desperate to get growth and make, you know, get the product into people's hands, they'll sacrifice a bit of the mission. And you can tell, you know, it shows in the packaging, it shows in the comms, it almost shows in the founder's fire. But it's really, really, really great to hear about that kind of just, I guess, that holistic approach, like no compromise. I really respect that, not just saying it. But just on that point, because I mean, it sounds like there's just innovation and just ideation is just an absolute core of how you guys have had success, always looking for the next kind of angle on how you can give people this kind of ancestry inspires the diets. Like, what's the best seller and what's coming down the pipeline that people should watch out for that's quite exciting, if you can share?
Yeah, cool. So, collagen has been a really big growth area for us. So, again, it's probably a bit of a weird one to go from avocado mayo to collagen. But when you're in the ancestral space, like, you don't see collagen as a supplement per se. It's part of your daily food. And it's where you get essential amino acids and protein and things like that from. So it's a bit of a in-between, that product. But that's a really fast growth area. It's really popular because it has results as well. People are seeing great outcomes, whether that's joint pain, gut health improvement, and then more of the beauty side, which everyone wants is a side effect, right? Of supporting your inner health, you then glow from the inside out. So it helps with hair, skin, nails, bones, joints. And as a healthy person, like you mentioned to me just before this about some guy that you're following that is kick-ass in his later on in
Mason Survival. Check him out on Instagram. It's great.
So that's what it's about. It's about being kick-ass in your 70s.
Oh, yeah.
So collagen is really helping people both now, and it spans all ages. From your early 20s, you start to reduce the amount of collagen you're naturally producing. So it's a really great product. But there is a lot of miscommunication and a lot of, like, I wouldn't say snake oil, that's a harsh term, but there's brands that are maybe doing lower doses than they should, blending it with other ingredients that don't need to be there to bulk it out, putting it in capsules with rice fillers, bulkers. So we're about that purity. But at the moment, we have two collagens, an arena and a bovine, quite functional in their nature. And what we want to do is make that more accessible for people, but keeping real natural, good quality ingredients. So we want to blend the supplement and food world a little bit more. So bringing in flavors, making it like an enjoyable experience. Some people are a little concerned about what could the taste be like. So we want to make that experience really positive. All of our products like taste great as well as doing good. And we don't compromise on that. So we're definitely going to innovate more in the kind of supplements, collagen space, but blurring those lines between food and supplements for sure.
That's really interesting. Yeah, yeah. Something me and my wife started doing that. We started reading about collagen a while back is we always do like a Sunday roast and we were pretty eccentric. We've got six kids, so there's a lot of food in the house basically. So we were just like throwing all these bones away and then we read about how good natural stock is. So we're just like boiling down all the like veg peelings going in it as well. So I'm making our own stock every week. And then my wife will cook up like two batches of soup for the kids that are then just like naturally packed from all this good stuff from like boiling all the bones. So like we're having a kitchen refit for those who can't do it, but the kids will be like, oh, where's all the tasty soup? And they absolutely love it. Like the taste that you get from like homemade stock, it's incredible. But like that point you made earlier about trying to sort of, is it a supplement, is it food? And I think sometimes you want to go to the effort to do everything from scratch and, you know, do your homemade stock. But like we still live in a modern life, don't we, with, you know, electric lights and 24/7 service. And say for me going into the office every day, it's hard to eat well in the office. So I kind of rely on stuff that I can just keep in the cupboard, you know, supplements and stuff like protein powders I can put in my yoghurt, etc. And yeah, and then once you start to go down that rabbit hole, you realize actually, yeah, all supplements and protein powders, they're not created equal. Like I started to look into like some of the proteins I was buying, like massively packed full of fillers and loads of soy stuff as well. And actually, yeah, when I swapped something, was much sort of more stripped back, just pure whey protein, massive impact on my gut health. And it's just a fascinating area, like just endlessly interests me. So I just love the fact that you're kind of like, yeah, constantly sort of like playing with it and kind of like understanding, right, what do people want? Where's next? How can we help people out? Like, is there a, do you, say it's in a business where you're so involved, you've seen, you know, you're in it with your partner, and you've been doing it for a while. It's obviously like, it seems like it's a real kind of, almost like personal mission for you as well. Like, how do you switch off? Because I'm always interested chatting to founders, like, how do you get that balance between work and play for something that you're genuinely passionate about beyond just paying the bills?
Yeah, I think this goes back to you as an individual person. Like, I learned the skill of switching my mind onto different things quite early on. So when I was at university, I worked to support myself. So I had, at one point, I had four different jobs whilst doing a uni degree. So I was working in a shop, working as a waitress, working at a zoo, working in a pub. Might only have been like one night a week or whatever in the particular pub, but what it taught me was context switching. So I'm not, everyone can do this, my partner Jeff can't. I'm a very strong context switcher and I can do that, and my mind works very much all in on one thing, and I do a lot of time blocking, so I've been very used to that just from a young age. Yeah, and that is good. If you're not that way, like, you don't have to go to that extreme of doing all different jobs, etc. But what it did, it was, it helped me. So when we first started Hunter and Gabber, we didn't have a lot of money. Jeff and I don't come from wealthy backgrounds. Like, this was a real hustle to get this going. We were very young founders as well. So I was 25 when we started the business, had a mortgage to pay. Had done things kind of the hard way, I'd say, and risky as well. And so that meant I had to keep working. So again, I had to cement that context switching of life, my day job at Lily's Kitchen, and then coming home and working on Hunter and Gabber. Yeah. And when I was at Lily's Kitchen, I was at Lily's Kitchen. Mm-hmm. And when I was at Hunter and Gabber, I was at Hunter and Gabber. The best way to do that is time block. There are some tools as well, like I do something called Inbox Zero, And I use Asana as well. So these really help keep you on track.
What's that? And Asana, so, you say?
Asana. It's a project management tool. There's others like Monday, Trello, but we just prefer Notion is another one that's quite good now. But what that does then, it means you haven't got all these things floating around in your head all the time. So that, and you can set tasks. And I use my inbox as like a to-do list. So if I going into my inbox, if I open an email, I either action it or delete it, or I won't open it if it's in my inbox and it's there. It's just past. And within the business, we've fostered a culture of no emails as much as possible. So everything's done via project management on Asana. So I won't email my team about project. They may get an all email for everyone about a team meeting or something. But if it's related to a project, it's all within Asana. So you don't have to hunt around. You don't get endless noise. And you don't have, I hate unclosed loops of information. So that really helps. And then personal life, I kind of force time away with my hobby. So I've got 3 horses. So I ride 6 days a week.
Really?
Yeah, I spend about 3 hours a day at the stables. So
I don't think I've spoken to many founders that sort of manage to get that much time for their stuff outside of work. That's great.
Yeah, and I do question sometimes, could we have gone faster if I'd have worked harder? But then you get burnout, and it's not a sprint. If you're in this business, you're growing a business, whether it's for an acquisition or to pass down, or it's a lifestyle piece, like your breakaway is really important as well. So I force it through kind of the animals. I have to leave, like their life is more important than an email. So trying to have those things in your life. Jeff has dogs. We have 2 dogs as well. So that gets him away. And just working on that balance. And yeah, when you're out of the office, leave your laptop there even, shut it down. I don't have loads of notifications going on my phone for work stuff. I don't have my Asana on there, for example. So it's just being strict about the time blocking.
Right, that's really interesting. That's a really good resource for anybody listening that's kind of looking about how to sort of get some good life hacks on hustling top of the day job. Just I'm sure where we were, like, you know, 4 or 4.5 minutes left for this podcast, I just want to squeeze every bit of value out for people listening, watching. Any kind of final advice for somebody watching or listening who is interested in kind of exploring this space? Maybe they've been sort of really interested in the kind of the conversation around plant-based and the conversation about ancestral nutrition, and that they're kind of trying to weigh up, okay, so, you know, where does the balance kind of come between sort of health and ethics? Like, any kind of good resources jumping forward for people to kind of get their head around, look, how can I be a better health-conscious, planet-conscious consumer?
Yeah, there's a lot of misinformation out there. It was a bit like the gluten-free health promo that happened when that supermarket aisle came out, and then everyone realised actually they put more salt, sugar and poor quality fats into these foods to make them taste better, so they're not actually healthier for you necessarily as a swap. So it's a bit like that at the moment, both with greenwashing and with health of products. So the fact that you're taking a conscious choice to explore this is amazing. You'll be in the top percent of the population, so that's great. Do your research across with plant-based. If you're doing a whole foods plant-based diet, that's going to be significantly better than a really highly processed Western high seed oil, high grain, high poor quality foods. But in our personal view, there is a place for animal agriculture if it's regenerative, both for your health and the planet. So there are essential kind of nutrients in animal products like B12 that you would have to take supplementary, or a lot of foods are fortified in the plant-based industry. So you need to ensure that you are actually getting what you need, because a plant-based diet is lacking if it's not fortified. So be aware of that. And then with the regenerative agriculture piece, if you're having Pasture for Life, that's a really good resource to find local, fully grass-fed, pasture-raised animals that are ethically produced. And there's some good books to help with kind of your thought process around this. So The Sacred Cow is a really good book. They do actually have a documentary as well that you can get online that delves into this in terms of like greenhouse gas emissions, and it's not as clear cut as it seems to be. And then in terms of like nutrition, I would check out obviously hunterandgatherfoods.com for our free ebooks. We have a lot on there. And then I'd say just don't take headlines like for what they are, because back in the day it was being touted that smoking was good for your health, and then behind sugar was great for energy on those Weet-Bits that Jeff was having. Yeah. Time prevailed. We believe seed oils, ultra processed plant-based foods are going to down the line be the next thing that's kind of not great for your health.
That is fascinating. Right, we've got 1.5 minutes left. So what I was trying to say to everyone listening and watching is, look, if you've enjoyed today, please reach out to Amy and Jeff and the team at Hunter & Gather. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for your time, Amy, and the insights. And more importantly, go and find the socials, follow them, find the website, buy some of their products, check out the collagen, check out the avocado mayo. I'm certainly going to do that today. And look, thanks again, Amy, for your time. It's been really great. And yeah, look forward to following the journey.
Thanks so much for having me.
Awesome.